Welcome to this seventh edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the third chapter, part two, titled Religion and the Meaning of Life. This one will focus on finding meaning in our lives. Our previous discussion differentiated religion from spirituality. Now, let's get back to eschatology from the first chapter and the importance of each of us having a working definition for our lives. I like this quote from Edwin Dobbs, former editor of The Sciences in Harper's Magazine, February 1995. To have a workable cosmology is to be at home in the cosmos. To be in the process of creating a cosmology is to be traveling toward home. Let us pause to ask ourselves, am I at home in the cosmos? Am I cobbling together a workable cosmology for myself? We've said much of the eschatological point of view, or as Dobbs refers to it, a workable cosmology. Let's see if we can't go for the nuts and bolts of the issue now and figure out ways to create one, thereby giving meaning, or at least a foundation on which to build our lives. And remember from the very first, the introduction, Earth is not our home. Earth is our bedroom in our home, which is the cosmos. Psychiatrist Carl G. Jung wrote of the importance of finding meaning in life. Modern Man in Search of a Soul, previously cited, page 61. About a third of my cases are suffering from no clinically definable neuroses, but from a senselessness and emptiness of their lives. Among my patients from many countries, there is a considerable number who came to see me not because they were suffering from a neurosis, but because they could find no meaning in life, or were torturing themselves with questions which neither present-day philosophy nor religion could answer. Page 231. In Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl makes the claim that it isn't for us to ask what the meaning of life is, but rather for us to answer that question ourselves. Quote, ultimately, man should not ask what the meaning of his life is, but rather he must recognize that it is he who is asked. In a word, each man is questioned by life, and he can only answer to life by answering for his own life. To life he can only respond by being responsible. So it is not up to you to ask, what is the meaning of my life? What am I supposed to do? It's up to you to say to life, this is the meaning of my life. This is why I am here. This is what I am supposed to do. What is the meaning of your life? And if your answer is different from someone else's, that's fine. After all, you're different from everyone else. And God invites and enables you to search for your individual interpretation, your very own unique, individualized definition of life. This isn't a test where we can look over someone else's shoulder and copy their answers. There is no one right answer, no one size fits all. Only the answer that is right for you is right for you. Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, stresses the importance of finding meaning in life. The soul of the individual eternally hungers for the heroism of genuine being, and that the willingness to take on that responsibility is identical to the decision to live a meaningful life. Page XXXV. I think a metaphor might take this from the abstract into the concrete. Consider two scenarios. Scenario number one, a person with unlimited resources gives you a choice plot of land, 2 acres or so, with a terrific view, all utilities, and complete ownership. Also, he gives you carte blanche at a Home Depot or a Lowe's and says you have 10 years to build a home on that property and live in it. You might say you know nothing of building. That's okay. Both of these builder's supply stores have books, videos, everything you need. He recommends your first purchase be a book of house plans and go from there. 10 years later, he visits to see what kind of home you've built. Scenario number two. A person with unlimited resources gives you the keys to the home of your choice in a newly finished development. It's a nice neighborhood. The homes are upper middle class, 3,000-4,000 square feet. All you have to do is move into the home that pleases you most. Of these two scenarios, I think life is more like number one. We are given the means to build a life. What do we do with them? If after 10 years you're visited on your choice property and you've been living in a tent dumping garbage all over the place and have done nothing to improve the parcel, the person who gave you all this opportunity will be sorely disappointed. Theologically speaking, I think this is also an apt metaphor for the interplay of grace and works in our lives. And a word or two on grace, which I feel is largely a nebulous, hardly understood principle. We'll use the classic metaphor ratio, God is to us as we are to our children. Your 10-year-old daughter shows an interest in music and wants to learn piano. You purchase a piano, arrange for music lessons, buy sheet music, and transport her to and from the lessons. All of these things are things she can't do for herself. Very few 10-year-olds possess the resources to buy a piano. Her part, though, is to practice regularly, prepare for recitals, and improve the talent God has given her through the means you have given her. It is the same with us and God. He has given form to our lives and potentials, brought us along through the various stages as mentioned previously, and now in this mortal plane gives us a flesh and blood body and the means to keep it alive and growing. None of this we could have done on our own. That, among other things, is the grace of God doing for us as a parent the things we can't do for ourselves, but expecting rightfully that we make something of the gifts he has given us. Now back to the subject at hand. I can't give anything more than the most general of affirmations that your life, my life, each life truly has a meaning. Many, quite probably. We must sort them out, work on each with some kind of prioritization. What is it? For Diane Fossey, it was the gorillas of Africa, as related in her classic book, Gorillas in the Mist. Same with Jane Goodall and her chimpanzees. Your life's meaning doesn't have to be something grandiose and general, such as saving the world, finding a cure for cancer. Concentrate on specifics wherein you have interests and talents, and where God will guide, bless, and open doors, and let your life be part of the whole. It takes 500 pieces put together correctly to complete a 500-piece jigsaw puzzle. Each one of us is a piece of the puzzle. No one is the whole puzzle. Solzhenitsyn, previously cited in Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, writes poignantly on the meaning of life. For context, he's being transferred from one prison to another under guard, and while in a train station, he overhears the banal conversations of the free people. There are complaints about people who share their apartment and don't wipe their feet, tracking in mud and dirt. Complaints about a mother-in-law, the usual. He writes, quote, "You listen to all this, and the goose pimples of rejection run up and down your spine. To you, the true measure of things in the universe is so clear. And how can you bring it home to them? In the deep, deaf stillness of midnight, the doors of death cells are being swung open, and great-souled people are being dragged out to be shot. And you have the right to arrange your own life under the blue sky and the hot sun. So what's this about unwiped feet? And what's this about a mother-in-law? What about the main thing in life, all its riddles? If you want, I'll spell it out for you. Do not pursue what is illusory, property and position. All that is gained at the expense of your nerves, decade after decade, and it's confiscated in one fell night. Live with a steady superiority over life. Don't be afraid of misfortune, and do not yearn after happiness. It is, after all the same. The bitter doesn't last forever, and the sweet never fills the cup to overflowing. It is enough if you don't freeze in the cold and if thirst and hunger don't claw at your insides. Our envy of others devours us most of all. Rub your eyes and purify your heart, and prize above all else in the world those who love you and who wish you well. Do not hurt them or scold them, and never part from any of them in anger. After all, you simply do not know. It might be your last act before your arrest, and that will be how you are imprinted in their memory. Pages 591 through 592. Truth be known, we all have two specific assignments in this life, as I mentioned previously, learning to love and loving to learn. This will be detailed in the last chapter. From there, we have individual assignments, tasks to accomplish that may be similar, but not exactly like those of our fellows and sisters, and are reflective of and suited to our temperament and nature. The best I can do for anyone here is to send them on their way with the assurance that life does have a meaning for you, but you must find it on your own. It's not something that has yet to be developed or discovered, but rather rediscovered. In Lessons from the Light, What We Can Learn from the Near-Death Experience, Dr. Kenneth Ring assures us that each of us has a plan already worked out for our lives between us and God before we came to Earth, page 198. Everyone is loved infinitely and with incredible compassion. There is a plan, or one might say, a kind of blueprint for everyone's life, and while we each are free to embrace or reject it, the light is there to help us find it. If we can open ourselves to the light, invoke it into our lives, we will, in time, be shown our own way, and we will recognize it as ours unmistakably, because it will give us joy. Joy in living is the truest sign that we are living right. In Frankl's book previously cited, he writes of the time he was hacking away at icy ground through the night under the watch of a taunting, cruel guard. Remember, he was in Auschwitz at this time. While swinging his pickaxe, he held a conversation with his wife. She wasn't really there, at least in a mortal body, but he talked with her as if she were, and felt her presence strongly. It is most moving part of this very moving book. It turned out later she had died, though he didn't know it at the time. I have no doubt he was communing with her spirit, though he doesn't identify it as such. He writes, quote, "I was struggling to find the reason for my sufferings, my slow dying. In a last violent protest against the hopelessness of imminent death, I sensed my spirit piercing through the enveloping gloom. I felt it transcend that hopeless, meaningless world, and from somewhere I heard a victorious yes in answer to my question of the existence of an ultimate purpose," page 60. Man's Search for Meaning is perhaps the greatest book ever written regarding the importance of finding meaning in life. It's from the successful execution of this search that we know in which direction our soul should develop. Frankl tells of two men who had talked openly of committing suicide. In the Nazi concentration camps of World War II, it was relatively easy. The wire surrounding the perimeter was electrified, and to touch it was electrocution. Many did run into the wire purposely. As he counseled these two men, he later became a psychiatrist and counselor, he was able to extract a reason from each one to continue life. For one, it was a child he loved dearly and was waiting free in a foreign country. For the other, it was a series of scientific works that had yet to be published, pages 100 through 101. The reasons each one of us has for living vary, but are important keys in knowing in which direction our soul's development must proceed. Frankl says in both cases it was a question of getting them to realize that life was still expecting something from them. Something in the future was expected of them. That something Frankl claims, is to be found not within, but without. It has to be something larger than our own lives. The true meaning of life is to be discovered in the world rather than within man or his own psyche. Being human always points and is directed to something or someone other than oneself. The more one forgets himself by giving himself to a cause to serve or another person to love, the more human he is and the more he actualizes himself. Page 133, previously cited. This is the great message of Christianity and the sacrifice of Christ, the ultimate example of human development functioning in the cosmos. Frankl sums it up, we all had once been or had fancied ourselves to be somebody. Now we were treated like complete non-entities. The consciousness of one's inner value is anchored in higher, more spiritual things and cannot be shaken by your camp life. Page 83. In a compilation of near-death experiences of children, Melvin Morse and Paul Perry say the youngsters they interviewed give simple and clear answers to the purpose of life. Quote, revere life and see the intricate connections throughout the universe. And note there's nothing about curing cancer or finding an answer to war. Closer to the light, learning from the near-death experiences of children. Pages 190 through 191. Their messages sound almost like Robert Fulghum's book, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, Uncommon Thoughts on Common Things. Love your neighbor and cherish life. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Clean up your own mess. Be the best you can be. Contribute to society. Be nice, kind, and loving. I would add Thoreau's admonition, simplify, simplify. And now I'm going to take what seems to be a complete contradiction to the above. These next quotes are from Eric Hoffer's book, The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements. Here, Hoffer, a 50s philosopher and thinker, seeks to establish the importance of an individual finding meaning in his own life and not in an external mass movement. His observations, then we'll try for synthesis. Quote, faith in a holy cause is to a considerable extent a substitute for the lost faith in ourselves. The less justified a man is in claiming excellence for his own self, the more ready is he to claim all excellence for his nation, his religion, his race, or his holy cause. A man is likely to mind his own business when it is worth minding. When it is not, he takes his mind off his own meaningless affairs by minding other people's business. This minding of other people's business expresses itself in gossip, snooping, and meddling, and also in feverish interest in communal, national, and racial affairs. In running away from ourselves, we either fall on our neighbor's shoulder or fly at his throat. Page 14. Look at all the frustrations and arguments this minding of other people's business engenders in our current political atmosphere. Secondhand smoke, homeowners associations, the ACLU, anti-gay marriage, right to life. So where do we find meaning if not in causes larger than ourselves? I think the answer lies in putting first things first. It's the beam and mote principle as taught by Christ in the New Testament. Matthew chapter 7, verses 3 and 5. And why beholdest thou the mote? Quick note here, the word beam is as in a beam used in building, such as the beam at the top of your roof. In other words, a really big piece of lumber. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then thou shalt see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. In this 21st century, we have the airplane depressurization lesson. When the oxygen masks dangle down, first put yours on. Then you'll have the clear head needed to put the mask on a struggling child. Get your own act together first. Figure your life out first, and then help others. Though helping others along the way will also help you figure out your life. Did I say this would be simple? Hoffer notes a fundamental difference between the appeal of a mass movement and the appeal of a practical organization. The practical organization offers opportunities for self-advancement, and its appeal is mainly to self-interest. On the other hand, a mass movement, particularly in its active revivalist phase, appeals not to those intent on bolstering and advancing a cherished self, but to those who crave to be rid of an unwanted self, people who see their lives as irremediably spoiled and cannot find a worthwhile purpose in self-advancement. Page 12. I mentioned Jesus Christ above as the greatest example of the development of the human soul. When he had accomplished this development, he then had a use to which it could be put, which was dying for the salvation of a human race that he saw as being worthy of saving. His vision was worth the sacrifice of his life. Hoffer sums up his comments by saying, "We cannot be sure that we have something worth living for, unless we are ready to die for it. This readiness to die is evidence to ourselves and others that what we had to take as a substitute for an irrevocably missed or spoiled first choice is indeed the best there ever was." Page 16, previously cited. In a sense, Christ's missed or spoiled first choice was living forever as King of the Jews, which he could have done. He chose death and our salvation instead. As we examine our lives, is it possible that our first choices, which may have been missed or spoiled, are God's way of setting us up for our true purpose? Truthfully, and without detail, I have found that to be the case with my life. Hence this book, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, hence these podcasts based on that book. After, mind you, about 25 years of banging my head against rejections and being ignored. But it was worth it. And now, November 26, 2021, let me throw a monkey wrench into my own works, as I did in the prologue, with a quote from Jordan B. Peterson and his book, Beyond Order, 12 More Rules for Life. It follows up his book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. Published in 2021, so you can see I couldn't have put it in while editing and writing this edition. Page 65, he writes about meaning in life and how it finds us, rather than us finding it. This is going to contradict what I've written above about our responsibility to seek for meaning in our lives, but it's such an intriguing idea, and from such a source as Jordan Peterson, whom I greatly respect and admire, that I felt I'd be shortchanging you if I didn't put it in here. How this will affect the outcome of this chapter, I don't know. But here it is. Quote, "You do not choose what interests you. It chooses you. Something manifests itself out of the darkness as compelling, as worth living for. Following that, something moves us further down the road to the next meaningful manifestation, and so it goes as we continue to seek, develop, grow, and thrive." End quote. I love that quote so much I'm going to repeat the first part again. You do not choose what interests you. It chooses you. And you have to ask yourself right now, is something choosing you, knocking on your door, pushing at your heart? Pay attention. Maybe that's your meaning in life. So how does meaning in life come to us? Do we pursue, find, and grapple with it? Or do we sit patiently waiting for it to pounce on us? Taking a passive approach to finding meaning goes against my grain, but after nearly 25 years of banging my head against the brick wall of author rejections and finding meaning only in service in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I can see truth value in Peterson's statements. I can't really give any specific directions to help you find meaning in life. Try both methods. Pursue it and, if you catch it, Congratulations, way to go. If after much trying and frustration, maybe it's time to sit back, gain some sort of peace, and maybe your meaning will come out from behind your chair and sit in your lap. There seems to be an almost Christian active versus Buddhist passive approach here. I guess we can only say what works for you is what's right for you. Now, to sum up having meaning in our lives, in his book, Where God Lives, Melvin Morse gives a list of 10 secrets that he collected from hundreds of interviews with children who had near-death experiences. He calls them the secrets of the transformed. I quote them here in their entirety, in the belief that they represent the best summation for the laying of a foundation for an eschatological outlook in our lives, and for finding meaning in our lives as well. This is what we can learn and apply from those who have talked with God and come back to us. You'll find nothing weird or far-fetched here, no gurus on a mountaintop, no sitting naked and begging in the street. These secrets show there's a good melding of the eternal and temporal, spiritual and mortal, in the overall view of things, as I will repeat ad nauseum, ad infinitum, balance. Number one, quoting now from Melvin Morse, exercise. Do some form of enjoyable exercise every day for at least 30 minutes. Walk in a park, play catch with your daughter, wrestle with your son, use a home treadmill while watching television. Give daily exercise the same priority that you would work. Later on, as I examine the four aspects of the human personality, one of them is physical, and I will mention exercise. It is part of who and what we are, this physical part, which needs attention. Number two, patterns. Be here now. Pay attention to your life patterns. Keep a journal. Do active meditation, a form of meditation in which you acknowledge and comment on your thoughts and inner feelings. With active meditation, you address your concerns about such things as money, kids, marriage, and work, instead of using passive meditation to silence your inner narrator. Instead of trying not to think about a disagreeable boss, you actually think about him or her, focusing on the source of conflict and trying to reach a solution to your problem. Number three, family and relationships. Eat breakfast and dinner with your family at least 4 times a week. Turn off the TV and talk to each other. Develop the habit of listening to others for at least 15 minutes a day. Let others finish their sentences before you start to think of a response. Say such things as, "How did you feel about that? Tell me more." Or simply repeat the last few words they said to you out loud in a reflective way. Now, he mentions turn off the TV. This was written before we had all these devices and iPods and all these other things with which I am totally unfamiliar. Shut those things down for your dinners and breakfast as well. Talk to each other face to face. Relate to your family. Trust your inner vision and intuition. Most people do not lack for spiritual experiences or intuitions. They lack the courage to believe them and therefore dismiss them. Boy, have I had trouble with that. Service. Help others on a weekly basis, even in simple ways. Give your wife a foot rub. Volunteer to be a soccer coach. Donate food to a food drive. One surefire cure for a sense of meaningless in life is to volunteer at a school, daycare center, or hospital. Number six, financial planning. Cut expenses. Pay at least 20% extra on your credit card debt each month. Over the years, this will lead to peace of mind, not just monetary savings. Saving money every month, even a small amount. When Einstein was asked about the greatest miracle in life, he replied, "Compound interest." Small amounts of money saved on a regular basis compound into enormous returns. What does this have to do with spiritual harmony? In our society, it is easier to find spiritual harmony when you have money in the bank and are not burdened with a lot of debt and worrying about it. Diet. Children who have had near-death experiences eat more fresh fruits and vegetables than the rest of us. meeting that spiritual light tends to good eating habits and, in turn, a longer, healthier life. Try to add one new vegetable a month to your diet as you subtract one fast food or snack food a week. Often, small changes can lead to successful, lifelong weight loss. Diets rarely do. Number 8, meditation / prayer. Talk to God. Spend at least 15 minutes a day allowing input from your right temporal lobe to come in. We'll speak about the right temporal lobe a little more later on. It has been called the God spot. If you don't want to pray actively or cannot think of anything to say, repeat a word over and over while lying in bed. This simple act turns on the right temporal lobe. Cosmos author's personal note, I found repeating the word peace while awaiting sleep at night can calm a restless heart and shut up the persistent and repetitive stressful dialogues that can plague us. I also picture Christ calming the waves of the sea with the words, peace, be still. Mark chapter 4, verse 39. This may not fit your religious predilections, however. Whatever works for you is what works. One might try other words such as love, mercy, forgiveness, or grace. And there's always the classic Buddhist meditation focusing symbol, Om. Number 9, learn to love. Often when we think of love, we mean self-love. Real love means thinking of someone else, that person's needs and feelings. It is hard to love. Often it involves a giving and sharing, which doesn't come naturally to many of us. You can learn to love, but it takes time and practice. I will spend 30 minutes a day jogging for my health. Spending 30 minutes a day loving, however, is just as good for your health. There are simple ways to do it. Commenting favorably on someone's new haircut is one way to make that person feel good. Another is to bring co-workers a treat in the morning or ask them how their children are doing in a play they are performing in. These are simple acts of caring that can help us all to break out of our isolation. Spirituality, rediscovering your relationship with all parts of the universe, becoming human in the cosmos. Pay attention to what is going on around you and see your place within it. This will act on many different levels, your relationships with other people, with the environment, and with God. This means different things to different people. For some, re-establishing a relationship with the universe will mean going to church once a week. For others, it means going to the beach or sitting in the park. Each person has his own way of addressing spirituality. The idea of kneeling before a bed and praying is offensive to some people who feel religion and spirituality have nothing in common. For others, religion is a conduit to the divine. Find what works for you and do not limit yourself. After all, there is more than one path to righteousness. Once again, Melvin Morse, Where God Lives, pages 31 through 34. One thing Dr. Morse didn't mention is intellectual stimulation and development. I've heard that the majority of college graduates don't read anymore once they have their degree, or at least don't read anything serious that would contribute to learning. My guess is that Dr. Morse missed this because he is a researcher and serious reading is a normal part of his life, so he was too close to the idea of intellectual stimulation for it to show up as something new on his radar. In the last chapter, I'll cover the two great purposes we all have in common in this life. Learn to love, love to learn. So I won't elaborate here. Suffice it to say that I do believe intellectual development is a vitally important part of our life's purpose. Most in-depth near experiences tell of libraries, schools, and intellectual pursuits on the other side. Lawrence Tooley's book, I Saw Heaven, reports how he was given a tour of a learning center. In this area, he observed several outdoor classrooms and asked his guide what the spirits were studying. Just about everything, came the answer. It isn't important what you study. Here, everyone has a burning thirst for knowledge. One of our greatest joys here is the pursuit of knowledge. Page 75. My guess would be the same is true here. It doesn't matter what you study, let your heart lead. Study is not for a degree unless you need one for career advancement, but study for the joy of learning. The bottom line is we have to take the initiative in our own intellectual development. The first and greatest commandment is to love God with all our heart, might, mind, and strength, Mark 12:30. Mind, therefore, is one-fourth of our love for God, and if we neglect its development, we aren't giving God all we have, or we are at least shortchanging him on the love that could come from a more developed mind. I would personally add to Morse's list being proactive in one's intellectual development. In a later chapter on human nature, we'll consider the four aspects of the complete human being as mentioned in Mark. The mind is one of them, and if ignored, we stagnate just as surely if we substitute watching TV for family interaction or a good, refreshing workout. Joyce H. Brown, who has been there and returned, says this of TV and movies. Directly after my experience on the other side, with my new knowledge of the value of time, I thought I would never again watch television or sit for hours in a movie theater. Now, however, I work at keeping a balance between worthwhile goals and needed leisure time. I do watch some television, but I am careful of quantity, content, and quality. I want the benefits of surrounding myself with inspirational and educational things, rather than detrimental, destructive words or scenes. End quote, previously cited, page 177. May I here put in a personal plug for the series from the Great Books, or from the, rather, the Teaching Company, The Great Lectures, also known as Wondrium. They have a series of college courses available for cable TV, and it's something worthy of you to Google and find out. Google the great courses and see what you can come up with. I've subscribed to that for several months now and have taken courses in medieval ages, which I knew very little about, history of the Jews, and history of Charlemagne. I'm a history buff. And an excellent course by Daniel Robinson, which I quote in this book, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, on the greatest ideas in philosophy, plus lectures on Tchaikovsky and other great composers and musicians. So definitely worth it. I give them a plug without them knowing it. That is the ultimate purpose of an eschatological outlook. This life is short. Eternity is long. We must soberly and wisely prepare for it, just as a student in college, where we will spend only 4 to 6 years, must soberly and wisely prepare for an adult career life that will last a good 40 years. To sum up, let us say religion, though imperfect, does have its function. Howard Storm, in My Descent into Death, says, "The Bible teaches that each of us is free to choose whether we are proponents of God's will or opponents of God's will. The question is, are you seeking God's will, or are you not? Knowing and doing God's will is the curriculum in this life. The church, as flawed as it may be, is the instrument to help us know God's will. The church is the closest we will get to God outside of heaven. The secular world is the place where we are sent to do the work of the Spirit of Christ." Page 116, previously cited. But for this book and our current status, we now have something to direct our lives towards. Life does have meaning, even if we have to largely take the bull by the horns and make it up for ourselves. And the meaning that life has for us is a product largely of our own freedom to choose, our agency, within the setting and context that God has given us with his program for our growth and development based on our personality and the sacred individuality of our eternal spirits. We deal with that next. And thus we conclude this 7th podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos. based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled The Plan of Happiness and Agency, Part 1, and will deal with God's plans for us. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in. And special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com. That's hazelleproductions.com. And thank you for tuning in.